I envy his serenity, humility, and air of quiet command. Thus speaks the automatic, mechanical voice of self-judgment in my mind. Now my goal is only that each day I should become closer to the God that I understand. The greatest teaching I have received is that I can be happy without imposing my will on you or anyone else, even when I feel like doing so. You may not believe you can surrender, but as you do, there will be a shift. You'll know there's a shift because your heart changes. As you study the big book, and you serve people and help the community, your heart softens. That's the greatest gift, a soft heart. I wouldn't have believed it. Yes, a soft heart. How quickly my heart hardens, and how brittle a hard heart can be. The last speaker is Elaine, alcoholic. Hi, Elaine. In the eyes of the newcomers, she begins, I see sadness, hunger, desperation. How will I ever have a life again? How will I get money? How will I build a relationship? Not my problems, I think. Still, I wonder, what would she see in my eyes? Nothing's going to happen overnight for most of you. It took me a long time of coming to these meetings before I could hear anything, and that didn't sit well with me. Two things alcoholics hate is work and time. There has to be no effort involved, and you want the results right now. Chuckles and applause. That's me. I resist emotional work, and I do want immediate results. A sense of urgency typifies attention deficit disorder, I wrote in Scattered Minds. A desperation to have immediately whatever it is that one may desire at the moment, be it an object, an activity, or a relationship. If it doesn't happen quickly for me, I feel like bailing, and unless I'm extraordinarily motivated, I often do. I used to be a militant party girl, Elaine continues in her Lauren Bacall voice, auburn-dyed bangs falling over her forehead above large, heavily painted eyes. I wasn't going to take anything seriously except having a good time, and that meant being stone drunk. Three things that didn't help me were love, education, and punishment. I didn't learn no matter how hard people tried to love me, no matter what facts I knew, and no matter how many times life taught me harsh lessons. I didn't learn until I began to listen. The first time I listened was at an AA meeting in Toronto. A native man in his 60s was speaking. I've been sober for 2 years now, he said, and 6 months ago I got my first job. If I had known how good it felt to work, I would have been done with drinking long ago. 5 months ago I got my own place. Had I known how good that was, I would have gone sober long ago. 3 months ago, I got myself a girlfriend. Boy, if I'd known how great that was, I might have never drank in the first place. Merriment chortles, the clapping of appreciative hands. Now I'm 64, the man said, and I've just been told I have cancer. I have 6 months to live. Elaine pauses to look around the room as we take in this information. Silently, we wait for her conclusion. I thought he's going to announce, I'm off on the biggest 6 month drunk you can imagine, so the hell with you all and goodbye. That's what I would have done with a death sentence hanging over me. But not this native man. I'm just so grateful, he said, so thankful that I'm sober, that I've had 2 years of sobriety, and that I can look forward to the rest of my life in sobriety. And that's when I got that sobriety is more than just the absence of alcohol. It's a way of being. It's living life in its fullness. Do I have to become an alcoholic? Lose everything, puke my guts out, and then get religion before I can experience the fullness of life, whatever the hell that means? I'm resentful. No, I'm anxious, fearful that it will never happen for me. That's what Elaine would have seen in my eyes. Or saw. Perhaps I was the newcomer she was talking about. Elaine is about to leave the lectern amidst nods of approval, but she steps behind the microphone once more. I don't mean, she says, that my life is perfect. Sometimes it feels like things are completely falling apart. Like this week. But I no longer confuse stuff that happens with my life. This moment is okay, even when things are coming apart at the seams. Right here, right now, At this moment, things are okay. Forget about your life situation for a while and pay attention to your life, writes the spiritual teacher Eckhart Tolle. Your life situation exists in time. Your life is now. I have read his book over and over, have underlined that phrase, and understand it intellectually. This woman, Elaine, doesn't only understand it. She gets it. It's a truth she's discovered for herself. Surrender is the key, says Elaine. Even now, whenever I try too hard, I mess it all up. Don't try. Just listen to God's directions. Fuck. That God thing again. What God? Ever since I was a child, I've been shaking my fist at heaven. From the moment I had a mind of my own, I knew there was no all-knowing, all-powerful, all-loving God. In Eastern Europe, under the Stalinist regimes, there used to be a saying, you can be honest, or intelligent, or be a member of the Communist Party. In fact, you can be any two of the three, but not all three at the same time. In the same way, I understood that God could be all-knowing and all-powerful, but not all-loving. How else to explain the murder of my grandparents in the gas chambers of Auschwitz, or of my own near death as an infant in the Budapest ghetto? Or God can be all-loving and all-knowing, but not omnipotent, a milksop, a weakling. So what is this God whose directions I'm supposed to obey? My moment of rebellion over, I know better, and remember Peter's words. My goal is only that each day I should become closer to the God that I understand. The God I understand. Not the willful old man in the sky I've resented all my life. Truth. Essence. The inner voice I keep running away from. That's the God I've been resisting. If Jonah-like, I'd rather hide in the stinking belly of a whale than face the truth I know so well, it's not because of intelligence, but because of the refusal to surrender. To surrender, you have to give something up. I've been unwilling to do that. And Yahweh said to Moshe, I see this people, and here it is a stiff-necked people. A few logistical details dealt with, chairs stacked, the meeting is over. I'm surprised by how quickly many people head for the exit. When I step outside, I see why. They're all in the parking lot, drawing puffs on their cigarettes and holding animated conversations in pairs or small groups. Smoke, bluish in the light thrown by the church windows, hangs in the air and dissipates slowly above them. I seek Peter, the burly former drinker and drug dealer. I feel drawn to him and believe he may have something to teach me. He's conversing with two or three other men, their faces intermittently lit by cigarette glow. I'm too shy to approach. As I stand there hesitating, I feel a hand on my shoulder. I turn my head. A woman is smiling at me. Dr. Gabor Mate, I thought that was you. My name is Sophie. You delivered my baby 19 years ago. You probably don't remember. I don't, but nice to see you. Sophie, she reminds me, was 21 years old when I attended the delivery of her child. As it turns out, far from feeling embarrassed at encountering a former patient at an AA event, I'm glad to be greeted by a friendly face. Tell me something. Do I belong here? I give the one-minute version of my history. You do belong. Sophie explains that the meeting is open to everyone. If you have addictive behaviors, this is the right place for you. Unless it's marked with a C for closed in the AA schedule, anyone with a problem is welcome. The C meetings are for alcoholics only. I will come back, I decide. What I've witnessed here are humility, gratitude, commitment, acceptance, support, and authenticity. I so desperately want those qualities for myself. Nowhere do I see such power and grace as at my AA meetings, a writer friend has told me. A manic depressive with a long history of alcoholism, she's been attending for 15 years, and she's been urging me to do so. I finally get what she means. As I walk to my car, I see Sophie approach a group of her friends. You wouldn't believe who I just ran into, I hear her say. I chuckle inwardly. my ego's yearning to be recognized, and the fear of it realized at the last possible moment. Part 3. A different state of the brain. Recent brain imaging studies have revealed an underlying disruption to brain regions that are important for the normal processes of motivation, reward, and inhibitory control in addicted individuals. This provides the basis for a different view that drug addiction is a disease of the brain, and the associated abnormal behavior is the result of dysfunction of brain tissue, just as cardiac insufficiency is a disease of the heart. Dr. Nora Volkow, Director, U.S. National Institute on Drug Abuse. Chapter 11. What is addiction? Addicts and addictions are part of our cultural landscape and lexicon. We all know who and what they are, or think we do. In this section of the book, we'll look at the subject from a scientific perspective, beginning with a working definition of addiction. We also need to dispel some common misconceptions. In the English language, addiction has two overlapping but distinct meanings. In our day, it most commonly refers to a dysfunctional dependence on drugs or on other behaviors such as gambling or sex or eating. Surprisingly, that meaning is only about 100 years old. For centuries before then, at least back to Shakespeare, addiction referred simply to an activity that one was passionate about or committed to, gave one's time to. "Sir, what sciences have you addicted yourself to?" someone asks the knight Don Quixote in an 18th century English translation of the Cervantes classic. In the 19th century Confessions of an English Opium Eater, Thomas de Quincey never once refers to his narcotic habit as an addiction, even if by our current definition it certainly was. The pathological sense of the word arose in the early 20th century. The term's original root comes from the Latin addicere, assigned to, from dicere, to say, and the prefix ad, to. That yields the word's traditional, innocuous meaning, a habitual activity or interest, often with a positive purpose. The Victorian-era British politician William Gladstone wrote about addiction to agricultural pursuits, implying a perfectly admirable vocation. But the Romans had another, more ominous usage that speaks to our present-day interpretation. An addictus was a person who, having defaulted on a debt, was assigned to his creditor as a slave. Hence, addiction's modern sense as enslavement to a habit. De Quincey anticipated that meaning when he acknowledged the chain of abject slavery forged by his narcotic dependence. What then is addiction? In the words of a consensus statement by addiction experts in 2001, addiction is a chronic neurobiological disease characterized by behaviors that include one or more of the following: impaired control over drug use, compulsive use, continued use despite harm, and craving. The key features of substance addiction are the use of drugs or alcohol despite negative consequences and relapse. I've heard some people shrug off their addictive tendencies by saying, for example, "I can't be an alcoholic, I don't drink that much." Or, "I only drink at certain times." The issue is not the quantity or even the frequency, but the impact. An addict continues to use a drug when evidence strongly demonstrates the drug is doing significant harm. If users show the pattern of preoccupation and compulsive use repeatedly over time with relapse, addiction can be identified. Helpful as such definitions are, we have to take a broader view to understand addiction fully. There is a fundamental addiction process that can express itself in many ways, through many different habits. The use of substances like heroin, cocaine, nicotine, and alcohol are only the most obvious examples, the most laden with the risk of physiological and medical consequences. Many behavioral non-substance addictions can also be highly destructive to physical health, psychological balance, and personal and social relationships. Addiction is any repeated behavior substance-related or not, in which a person feels compelled to persist, regardless of its negative impact on his life and the lives of others. Addiction involves 1. Compulsive engagement with the behavior, a preoccupation with it. 2. Impaired control over the behavior. 3. Persistence or relapse despite evidence of harm. And 4. Dissatisfaction, irritability, or intense craving when the object, be it a drug, activity, or other goal, is not immediately available. Compulsion, impaired control, persistence, irritability, relapse, and craving. These are the hallmarks of addiction, any addiction. Not all harmful compulsions are addictions, though. An obsessive compulsive, for example, also has impaired control and persists in a ritualized and psychologically debilitating behavior, such as, say, repeated hand washing. The difference is that he has no craving for it, and unlike the addict, he gets no kick out of his compulsion. How does the addict know she has impaired control? Because she doesn't stop the behavior in spite of its ill effects. She makes promises to herself or others to quit. But despite pain, peril, and promises, she keeps relapsing. There are exceptions, of course. Some addicts never recognize the harm their behaviors cause and never form resolutions to end them. They stay in denial and rationalization. Others openly accept the risk, resolving to live and die my way. As we shall see shortly, all addictions, whether to drugs or to non-drug behaviors, share the same brain circuits and brain chemicals. On the biochemical level, the purpose of all addictions is to create an altered physiological state in the brain. This can be achieved in many ways, drug taking being the most direct. So an addiction is never purely psychological. All addictions have a biological dimension. And here a word about dimensions. As we delve into the scientific research, we need to avoid the trap of believing that addiction can be reduced to the actions of brain chemicals or nerve circuits or any other kind of neurobiological, psychological, or sociological data. A multi-level exploration is necessary, because it's impossible to understand addiction fully from any one perspective, no matter how accurate. Addiction is a complex condition, a complex interaction between human beings and their environment. We need to view it simultaneously from many different angles, or at least while examining it from one angle, we need to keep the others in mind. Addiction has biological, chemical, neurological, psychological, medical, emotional, social, political, economic, and spiritual underpinnings, and perhaps others I haven't thought about. To get anywhere near a complete picture, we must keep shaking the kaleidoscope to see what other patterns emerge. Because the addiction process is too multifaceted to be understood within any limited framework, my definition of addiction made no mention of disease. Viewing addiction as an illness, either acquired or inherited, narrows it down to a medical issue. It does have some of the features of illness, and these are most pronounced in hardcore drug addicts like the ones I work with in the downtown East Side. But not for a moment do I wish to promote the belief that the disease model by itself explains addiction, or even that it's the key to understanding what addiction is all about. Addiction is all about many things. Note, too, that neither the textbook definitions of drug addiction, nor the broader view we're taking here, includes the concepts of physical dependence or tolerance as criteria for addiction. Tolerance is an instance of give an inch, take a mile. That is, the addict needs to use more and more of the same substance or engage in more and more of the same behavior to get the same rewarding effects. Although tolerance is a common effect of many addictions, a person does not need to have developed a tolerance to be addicted. And then there's physical dependence. As defined in medical terms, physical dependence is manifested when a person stops taking a substance and, due to changes in the brain and body, she experiences withdrawal symptoms. Those temporary, drug-induced changes form the basis of physical dependence. Although a feature of drug addiction, a person's physical dependence on a substance does not necessarily imply that he is addicted to it. The withdrawal syndrome is different for each class of drug. In the case of opiates such as morphine or heroin, it includes nausea, diarrhea, sweats, aches and pains, and weakness, as well as severe anxiety, agitation, and depressed mood. But you don't have to be addicted to experience withdrawal. You just have to have been taking a medication for an extended period of time. As many people have discovered to their chagrin, with abrupt cessation, it's quite possible to suffer highly unpleasant withdrawal symptoms from drugs that are not addictive. The antidepressants paroxetine, Paxil, and venlafaxine, Effexor, are but two examples. The withdrawal does not mean you were addicted. For addiction, there also needs to be craving and relapse. In fact, in the case of narcotics, it turns out that the addictive feel-good effects of these drugs seems to act in a different part of the brain than the effects that lead to physical dependence. When morphine is infused only into the reward circuits of a rat's brain, addiction-like behavior results. But there's no physical dependence and no withdrawal. Dependence can also be understood as a powerful attachment to harmful substances or behaviors, and this definition gives a clearer picture of addiction. The addict comes to depend on the substance or behavior in order to make himself feel momentarily calmer or more excited or less dissatisfied with his life. That's the meaning I'll be referring to, unless I am specifically describing physical dependence, the narrower medical phenomenon. Father Sam Partaro, author and former Episcopalian chaplain to the University of Chicago, said it admirably well in a recent lecture. The heart of addiction is dependency, excessive dependency, unhealthy dependency. Unhealthy in the sense of unwhole, dependency that disintegrates and destroys. Chapter 12. From Vietnam to Rat Park. Do drugs cause addiction? In the cloudy swirl of misleading ideas surrounding public discussion of addiction, there's one that stands out. The misconception that drug taking by itself will lead to addiction. In other words, that the cause of addiction resides in the power of the drug over the human brain. It is one of the bedrock fables sustaining the so-called war on drugs. It also obscures the existence of a basic addiction process of which drugs are only one possible object among many. Compulsive gambling, for example, is widely considered to be a form of addiction without anyone arguing that it's caused by a deck of cards. The notion that addiction is drug-induced is often reinforced. A celebrity, for instance, might announce when checking himself into a rehab center that he became hooked on narcotics after they were prescribed for, say, a back injury. Making a career out of pratfalls eventually took a toll on Jerry Lewis, reported the Associated Press in April 2005. The entertainer said Sunday on ABC's This Week that he spent 37 years in constant pain as a result of his trademark physical comedy, which led to an addiction to pills. In 1965, they gave me one Percodan that took me through the whole day, and by 78, I was taking 13 a day, 15 a day. The addiction is devastating, because you're not even clear anymore why you're taking it. I had already discussed a variety of options, one of which was to kill myself, he said. I also took Percodan at one time, for a few days. After a wisdom tooth extraction about 30 years ago, I developed a condition called dry socket syndrome, which I'd never heard about before and never wished to hear of again. The pain in my jaw was excruciating. I was swallowing Percodan in higher than recommended doses and more frequently than prescribed. Finally, the third dental surgeon I consulted diagnosed the problem and cleaned and packed the infected socket. The pain then abated, and I've never taken Percodan or any other narcotic since. Clearly, if drugs by themselves could cause addiction, we would not be safe offering narcotics to anyone. Medical evidence has repeatedly shown that opioids prescribed for cancer pain, even for long periods of time, do not lead to addiction except in a minority of susceptible people. During my years working on a palliative care ward, I sometimes treated terminally ill cancer patients with extraordinarily high doses of narcotics, doses that my hardcore addict clients could only dream of. If the pain was alleviated by other means, for example, when a patient was successfully given a nerve block for bone pain due to malignant deposits in the spine, the morphine could be rapidly discontinued. Yet, if anyone had reason to seek oblivion through narcotic addiction, it would have been these terminally ill human beings. An article in the Canadian Journal of Medicine in 2006 reviewed international research covering over 6,000 people who had received narcotics for chronic pain that was not cancerous in origin. There was no significant risk of addiction, a finding common to all studies that examine the relationship between addiction and the use of narcotics for pain relief. Doubts or concerns about opioid efficacy, toxicity, tolerance, and abuse or addiction should no longer be used to justify withholding opioids, concluded a large study of patients with chronic pain due to rheumatic disease. We can never understand addiction if we look for its sources exclusively in the actions of chemicals, no matter how powerful they are. Addiction is a human problem that resides in people, not in the drug or in the drug's capacity to produce physical effects, writes Lance Dodes, a psychiatrist at the Harvard Medical School Division on Addictions. It is true that some people will become hooked on substances after only a few times of using, with potentially tragic consequences. But to understand why, we have to know what about those individuals makes them vulnerable to addiction. Mere exposure to a stimulant or narcotic or to any other mood-altering chemical does not make a person susceptible. If she becomes an addict, it's because she's already at risk. Heroin is considered to be a highly addictive drug, and it is, but only for a small minority of people, as the following example illustrates. It's well known that many American soldiers serving in the Vietnam War in the late 1960s and early 1970s were regular users. Along with heroin, most of these soldier addicts also used barbiturates or amphetamines, or both. According to a study published in the Archives of General Psychiatry in 1975, 20% of the returning enlisted men met the criteria for the diagnosis of addiction while they were in Southeast Asia, whereas before they were shipped overseas, fewer than 1% had been opiate addicts. The researchers were astonished to find that after Vietnam, use of particular drugs and combinations of drugs decreased to near or even below pre-service levels. The remission rate was 95%, unheard of among narcotics addicts treated in the U.S. Remission is a state of abatement or reduction of symptoms in illness or addiction. The high rates of narcotic use and addiction there were truly unlike anything prior in the American experience, the researchers concluded. Equally dramatic was the surprisingly high remission rate after return to the United States. These results suggested that the addiction did not arise from the heroin itself, but from the needs of the men who used the drug. Otherwise, most of them would have remained addicts. As with opiates, so too with the other commonly abused drugs. Most people who try them, even repeatedly, will not become addicted. I'm not suggesting here that for those people who do not become addicted, it's safe to use these drugs. I'm making a scientific case regarding the nature of addiction itself. According to a U.S. national survey, the highest rate of dependence after any use is for tobacco. 32% of people who use nicotine even once went on to long-term habitual use. For alcohol, marijuana, and cocaine, the rate is about 15%, and for heroin, the rate is 23%. Taken together, American and Canadian population surveys indicate that merely having used cocaine a number of times is associated with an addiction risk of less than 10%. This doesn't prove, of course, that nicotine is more addictive than, say, cocaine. We cannot know, since tobacco, unlike cocaine, is legally available, commercially promoted, and remains, more or less, a socially tolerated object of addiction. What such statistics do show is that whatever a drug's physical effects and powers, they cannot be the sole cause of addiction. For all that, there is a factual basis to the durable notion of certain drugs being inexorably addictive. Some people, a relatively small minority, are at grave risk for addiction if exposed to certain substances. For this minority, exposure to drugs really will trigger addiction, and the trajectory of drug dependence, once begun, is extremely difficult to stop. In the United States, opiate relapse rates of 80% to more than 90% have been recorded among addicts who try to quit their habit. Even after hospital treatment, the re-addiction rates are over 70%. Such dismal results have led to the impression that opiates themselves hold the power of addiction over human beings. Similarly, cocaine has been described in the media as the most addictive drug on earth, causing instant addiction. More recently, crystal methamphetamine, crystal meth, has gained a reputation as the most instantly powerful addiction-inducing drug. A well-deserved notoriety, so long as we keep in mind that the vast majority of people who use it do not become addicted. Statistics Canada reported in 2005, for example, that 4.6% of Canadians have tried crystal meth, but only 0.5% had used it in the past year. If the drug by itself induced addiction, the two figures would have been nearly identical. In one sense, certain substances like narcotics and stimulants, alcohol, nicotine, and marijuana can be said to be addictive. And it's in that sense that I use the term. These are the drugs for which animals and humans will develop craving and which they will seek compulsively. But this is far from saying that the addiction is caused directly by access to the drug. We will later explore why these substances have addictive potential. The reasons are deeply rooted in the neurobiology and psychology of emotions. Because almost all laboratory animals can be induced into compulsive self-administration of alcohol, stimulants, narcotics, and other substances, research has appeared to reinforce the view that mere exposure to drugs will lead indiscriminately to drug addiction. The problem with this apparently reasonable assumption is that animal laboratory studies can prove no such thing. The experience of caged animals does not accurately represent the lives of free creatures, including human beings. There is much to be learned from animal studies, but only if we take into account the real circumstances. And, I should add, only if we accept the tremendous suffering imposed on these involuntary subjects. Although there are anecdotes of animals in the wild becoming intoxicated, most of them are spurious, as is the case, for example, with stories of elephants getting drunk on fermenting marula fruit. There are no known examples of persistently addictive behaviors in the natural world. Of course, we cannot predict exactly what might happen if wild animals had free and easy access to addictive substances in the purified and potent forms administered in laboratories. What has been shown, however, is that conditions in the laboratory powerfully influence which animals will succumb to addiction. Among monkeys, for example, subordinate males who are stressed and relatively isolated are the ones more likely to self-administer cocaine. As I will later explain, being dominant leads to brain changes that give stronger monkeys some protection from an addictive response to cocaine. Bruce Alexander, a psychologist at Simon Fraser University in British Columbia, points out the obvious. Laboratory animals in particular can be induced into addiction because they live under unnatural circumstances of captivity and stress. Along with other astute researchers, Dr. Alexander has argued that drug self-administration by these creatures may be how the animals cope with the stress of social and sensory isolation. The animals may also be more prone to give themselves drugs because they are cooped up with the self-administration apparatus and cannot move freely. As we will see, emotional isolation, powerlessness, and stress are exactly the conditions that promote the neurobiology of addiction in human beings as well. Dr. Alexander has conducted elegant experiments to show that even lab rats, given reasonably normal living situations, will resist the addictive appeal of drugs. My colleagues and I built the most natural environment for rats that we could contrive in the laboratory. Rat Park, as it came to be called, was airy, spacious, with about 200 times the square footage of a standard laboratory cage. It was also scenic, with a peaceful British Columbia forest painted on the plywood walls. Comfortable, with empty tins, wood scraps, and other desiderata strewn about on the floor, and sociable, with 16 to 20 rats of both sexes in residence at once. We built a short tunnel opening into Rat Park that was just large enough to accommodate one rat at a time. At the far end of the tunnel, the rats could release a fluid from either of two drop dispensers. One dispenser contained a morphine solution, and the other an inert solution. It turned out that for the Rat Park animals, morphine held little attraction, even when it was dissolved in a sickeningly sweet liquid usually irresistible to rodents, and even after these rats were forced to consume morphine for weeks, to the point that they would develop distressing physical withdrawal symptoms if they didn't use it. In other words, in this natural environment, a rat will stay away from the drug if given a choice in the matter, even if it's already physically dependent on the narcotic. "Nothing that we tried," reported Bruce Alexander, "instilled a strong appetite for morphine or produced anything that looked like addiction in rats that were housed in a reasonably normal environment." By contrast, caged rats consumed up to 20 times more morphine than their relatively free-living relatives. Dr. Alexander first published these findings in 1981. In 1980, it had already been reported that social isolation increased animals' intake of morphine. Other scientists have since confirmed that some environmental conditions are likely to induce animals to use drugs. Given different conditions, even captive creatures can resist the lure of addiction. The Vietnam Veterans Study pointed to a similar conclusion. Under certain conditions of stress, many people can be made susceptible to addiction, but if circumstances change for the better, the addictive drive will abate. About half of all the American soldiers in Vietnam who began to use heroin developed addiction to the drug. Once the stress of military service in a brutal and dangerous war ended, so in the vast majority of cases did the addiction. The ones who persisted in heroin addiction back home were, for the most part, those with histories of unstable childhoods and previous drug use problems. In earlier military conflicts, relatively few U.S. military personnel succumbed to addiction. What distinguished the Vietnam experience from these wars? The ready availability of pure heroin and of other drugs is only part of the answer. This war, unlike previous ones, quickly lost meaning for those ordered to fight and die in the faraway jungles and fields of Southeast Asia. There was too wide a gap between what they'd been told and the reality they witnessed and experienced. Lack of meaning, not simply the dangers and privations of war, was the major source of the stress that triggered their flight to oblivion. Drugs, in short, do not make anyone into an addict, any more than food makes a person into a compulsive eater. There has to be a pre-existing vulnerability. There also has to be significant stress, as on these Vietnam soldiers. But, like drugs, external stressors by themselves, no matter how severe, are not enough. Although many Americans became addicted to heroin while in Vietnam, most did not. Thus, we might say that three factors need to coincide for substance addiction to occur: a susceptible organism, a drug with addictive potential, and stress. Given the availability of drugs, individual susceptibility will determine who becomes an addict and who will not. For example, which two from among a random sample of 10 U.S. GIs in Vietnam will fall prey to addiction. In the rest of this section, we'll investigate the roots of that susceptibility. Chapter 13, A Different State of the Brain. "Addiction is mysterious and irrational," writes the psychiatrist Robert DuPont, who was the first director of the U.S. National Institute on Drug Abuse and White House drug czar under Presidents Nixon and Ford. Perhaps another view is possible. Addiction is irrational, and at times the behavior of addicts seems mystifying, even to themselves. But what if we listen to addicts and hear their life histories, as we began to do in the first part of this book? And what can we learn if we survey the brilliant and extensive scientific literature that has examined addiction from almost every conceivable angle? I believe that if we look with an open mind at this phenomenon called addiction, the sense of mystery will be replaced by an appreciation of complexity. We are left, above all, with awe for the amazing workings of the human brain, and with compassion for those mesmerized by their addictive urges. What does the research tell us? As we have seen, laboratory animals can be led into drug and alcohol addiction. Hooked up to the appropriate apparatus and allowed unlimited access, many rats will self-administer intravenous cocaine to the point of hunger, exhaustion, and death. Researchers even know how to make some laboratory creatures, rats, mice, monkeys, and apes, more vulnerable to addiction by genetic manipulations or by interference with prenatal and postnatal development. Animal experiments, some truly disturbing to read in detail, have allowed for finely tuned research into the relationships between brain circuitry, behavior, and addiction. Through new imaging methods, we've been able to glimpse the human brain in action, under the immediate influence of drugs and after long-term drug use. Radioactive techniques and magnetic frequencies enable researchers to measure blood flow to the brain and to gauge the level of energy used by brain centers during various activities or certain emotional states. Electroencephalograms, EEGs, have identified abnormal electrical brainwave patterns in some young people who are at greater than normal risk for alcoholism. Scientists have looked at the chemistry of the addicted brain, at its neurological connections, and its anatomical structures. They've analyzed the workings of molecules, the membranes of cells, and the replication of genetic material. They've investigated how stress activates the brain circuitry of addiction. Large-scale studies have examined what hereditary predispositions might contribute to addiction and how early life experiences may shape the brain pathways of addiction. There are controversies, as we shall see, but everyone agrees that on the basic physiological level, addiction represents a different state of the brain, in the words of physician and researcher Charles O'Brien. The debate is over just exactly how that abnormal brain state arises. Are the changes in the addicted brain purely the consequence of drug use? Or is the brain of the habitual user somehow susceptible before drug use begins? Are there brain states that predispose a person to become addicted to drugs or to behaviors such as compulsive sexual adventuring or overeating? If so, are those predisposing brain states induced mostly by genetic inheritance or by life experience, or by some combination of both? The answer to these questions are crucially important for the treatment of addiction and for recovery. The drug-addicted brain doesn't work in the same way as the non-addicted brain, and when imaged by means of PET scans and MRIs, it doesn't look the same. PET, positron emission tomography, MRI, magnetic resonance imaging, two recently developed, sophisticated imaging techniques that are now yielding new information about brain structure and functioning. An MRI study in 2002 looked at the white matter in the brains of dozens of cocaine addicts from youth to middle age in comparison with the white matter of non-users. The brain's gray matter contains the cell bodies of nerve cells. Their connecting fibers, covered by fatty white tissue, form the white matter. As we age, we develop more active connections and therefore more white matter. In the brains of cocaine addicts, the age-related expansion of white matter is absent. Functionally, this means a loss of learning capacity, a diminished ability to make new choices, acquire new information, and adapt to new circumstances. It gets worse. Other studies have shown that gray matter density, too, is reduced in the cerebral cortex of cocaine addicts. That is, they have smaller or fewer nerve cells than normal. A diminished volume of gray matter has also been shown in heroin addicts and alcoholics, and this reduction in brain size is correlated with the years of use. The longer a person has been addicted, the greater the loss of volume. In the part of the cerebral cortex responsible for regulating emotional impulses and for making rational decisions, addicted brains have reduced activity. In special scanning studies, these brain centers have also exhibited diminished energy utilization in chronic substance users, indicating that the nerve cells and circuits in those locations are doing less work. When tested psychologically, these same addicts showed impaired functioning of their prefrontal cortex, the executive part of the human brain. Thus, the impairments of physiological function revealed through imaging were paralleled by a diminished capacity for rational thought. In animal studies, reduced nerve cell counts, altered electrical activity, and abnormal nerve cell branching in the brain were found after chronic cocaine use. Similarly, altered structure and branching of nerve cells has been seen after long-term opiate administration and also with chronic nicotine use. Such changes are sometimes reversible, but can last for a long time and may even be lifelong, depending on the duration and intensity of drug use. To write about the biology of addiction, one must write about dopamine, a key brain chemical messenger that plays a central role in all forms of addiction. An imaging study of rhesus monkeys, published in 2006, confirmed previous findings that the number of receptors for dopamine was reduced in chronic cocaine users. Receptors are the molecules on the surfaces of cells where chemical messengers fit and influence the activity of the cell. Every cell membrane holds many thousands of receptors for many types of messenger molecules. Cells receive input and direction from other parts of the brain and the body and from the outside by means of messenger-receptor interactions. If it wasn't for their ability to exchange messages with their environment, cells could not function. Cocaine and other stimulant-type drugs work because they greatly increase the amount of dopamine available to cells in essential brain centers. That sudden rise in the levels of dopamine, one of the brain's feel-good chemicals, accounts for the elation and sense of infinite potential experienced by the stimulant user, at least at the beginning of the drug habit. As mentioned, it was already known that the brains of chronic cocaine users had fewer than normal dopamine receptors. The fewer such receptors, the more the brain would welcome external substances that could help increase its available dopamine supply. This recent primate study showed for the first time that the monkeys who developed a higher rate of cocaine self-administration, the ones who became more hardcore users, had a lower number of these receptors to begin with, before ever having been exposed to the chemical. This illuminating finding suggests that among rhesus monkeys, who are considered to be excellent models of human addiction, some are much more prone to extremes of drug dependence than others. Stimulant drugs like cocaine and methamphetamine, crystal meth, exert their effect by making more dopamine available to cells that are activated by this brain chemical. Because dopamine is important for motivation, incentive, and energy, a diminished number of receptors will reduce the addict's stamina and his incentive and drive for normal activities when not using the drug. It's a vicious cycle. More cocaine use leads to more loss of dopamine receptors. The fewer receptors, the more the addict needs to supply his brain with an artificial chemical to make up for the lack. Why does chronic self-administration of cocaine reduce the density of dopamine receptors? It's a simple matter of brain economics. The brain is accustomed to a certain level of dopamine activity. If it is flooded with artificially high dopamine levels, it seeks to restore the equilibrium by reducing the number of receptors where the dopamine can act. This mechanism helps to explain the phenomenon of tolerance by which the user has to inject, ingest, or inhale higher and higher doses of a substance to get the same effect as before. If deprived of the drug, the user goes into withdrawal, partly because the diminished number of receptors can no longer generate the required normal dopamine activity. Hence the irritability, depressed mood, alienation, and extreme fatigue of the stimulant addict without his drug. This is the physical dependence state discussed in Chapter 11. It can take months or longer for the receptor numbers in the brain to rise back to pre-drug use figures. On the cellular level, addiction is all about neurotransmitters and their receptors. In different ways, all commonly abused drugs temporarily enhance the brain's dopamine functioning. Alcohol, marijuana, the opiates heroin and morphine, and stimulants such as nicotine, caffeine, cocaine, and crystal meth all have this effect. Cocaine, for example, blocks the reuptake or reentry of dopamine into the nerve cells from which it is originally released. Like all neurotransmitters, dopamine does its work in the space between cells, known as the synaptic space or cleft. A synapse is where the branches of two nerve cells converge without touching, and it's in a space between them that messages are chemically transmitted from one cell to the next. That is why the brain needs chemical messengers or neurotransmitters to function. Released from a neuron or nerve cell, a neurotransmitter such as dopamine floats across the synaptic space and attaches to receptors on a second neuron. Having carried its message to the target nerve cell, the molecule then falls back into the synaptic cleft, and from there, it is taken back up into the originating neuron for later reuse, hence the term reuptake. The greater the reuptake, the less neurotransmitter remains active between the neurons. Cocaine's action may be likened to that of the antidepressant fluoxetine, Prozac. Prozac belongs to a family of drugs that increase the levels of the mood-regulating neurotransmitter serotonin between nerve cells by blocking its reuptake. They're called selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, or SSRIs. Cocaine, one might say, is a dopamine reuptake inhibitor. It occupies the receptor on the cell surface normally used by the brain chemical that would transport dopamine back into its source neuron. In effect, cocaine is a temporary squatter in someone else's home. The more of these sites occupied by cocaine, the more dopamine remains in the synaptic space, and the greater the euphoria reported by the user. Unlike Prozac, cocaine is not selective. It also inhibits the reuptake of other messenger molecules, including serotonin. By contrast, nicotine directly triggers dopamine release from cells into the synaptic space. Crystal meth both releases dopamine, like nicotine, and blocks its reuptake, like cocaine. The power of crystal meth to rapidly multiply dopamine levels is responsible for its intense euphoric appeal. These stimulants directly increase dopamine levels, but the action of some chemicals on dopamine is indirect. Alcohol, for example, reduces the inhibition of dopamine-releasing cells. Narcotics like morphine act on natural opiate receptors on cell surfaces to trigger dopamine discharge. Activities such as eating or sexual contact also promote the presence of dopamine in the synaptic space. Dr. Richard Rawson, Associate Director of UCLA's Integrated Substance Abuse Program, reports that food seeking can increase brain dopamine levels in some key brain centers by 50%. Sexual arousal will do so by a factor of 100%, as will nicotine and alcohol. But none of these can compete with cocaine, which more than triples dopamine levels. Yet cocaine is a miser compared with crystal meth or speed, whose dopamine-enhancing effect is an astounding 1,200%. It's easy to see why the crystal meth-addicted woman Carol spoke of the drug's effect as an orgasm without sex. After repeated crystal meth use, the number of dopamine receptors in crucial brain circuits will be reduced, just as with cocaine. In short, drug use temporarily changes the brain's internal environment. The high is produced by means of a rapid chemical shift. There are also long-term consequences. Chronic drug use remodels the brain's chemical structure, its anatomy, and its physiological functioning. It even alters the way the genes act in the nuclei of the brain cells. Among the most insidious consequences to drugs of abuse is the vulnerability to craving and relapse after many weeks or years of abstinence, says a review of addiction neurobiology in a psychiatric journal. The enduring nature of this behavioral vulnerability implies long-lasting changes in brain function. Since the brain determines the way we act, these biological changes lead to altered behaviors. It is in this sense that medical language refers to addiction as a chronic disease, and it is in this sense of a drug-affected brain state that I think the disease model is useful. It may not fully define addiction, but it does help us understand some of its most important features. In any disease, say smoking-induced lung or heart disease, organs and tissues are damaged and function in pathological ways. When the brain is diseased, the functions that become pathological are the person's emotional life, thought processes, and behavior. And this creates addiction's central dilemma. If recovery is to occur, the brain, the impaired organ of decision-making, needs to initiate its own healing process. An altered and dysfunctional brain must decide that it wants to overcome its own dysfunction, to revert to normal, or perhaps become normal for the very first time. The worse the addiction is, the greater the brain abnormality, and the greater the biological obstacles to opting for health. The scientific literature is nearly unanimous in viewing drug addiction as a chronic brain condition, and this alone ought to discourage anyone from blaming or punishing the sufferer. No one, after all, blames a person suffering from rheumatoid arthritis for having a relapse, since relapse is one of the characteristics of chronic illness. The very concept of choice appears less clear-cut if we understand that the addict's ability to choose, if not absent, is certainly impaired. The evidence for addiction as a different state of the brain has important treatment implications, writes Dr. Charles O'Brien. Unfortunately, he adds, most healthcare systems continue to treat addiction as an acute disorder, if at all. Chapter 14. Through a needle, a warm, soft hug. All the substances that are the main drugs of abuse today originate in natural plant products and have been known to human beings for thousands of years. Opium, the basis of heroin, is an extract of the Asian poppy Papaver somniferum. 4,000 years ago, the Sumerians and Egyptians were already familiar with its usefulness in treating pain and diarrhea, and also with its powers to affect a person's psychological state. Cocaine is an extract of the leaves of Erythroxylon coca, a small tree that thrives on the eastern slopes of the Andes in western South America. Amazon Indians chewed coca long before the conquest as an antidote to fatigue and to reduce the need to eat on long, arduous mountain journeys. Coca was also venerated in spiritual practices. Native people called it the divine plant of the Incas. In what was probably the first ideological war on drugs in the New World, the Spanish invaders denounced coca's effects as a delusion from the devil. The hemp plant, from which marijuana is derived, first grew on the Indian subcontinent and was christened Cannabis sativa by the Swedish scientist Carl Linnaeus in 1753. It was also known to the ancient Persians, Arabs, and Chinese, and its earliest recorded pharmaceutical use appears in a Chinese compendium of medicine written nearly 3,000 years ago. Stimulants derived from plants were also used by the ancient Chinese, for example, in the treatment of nasal and bronchial congestion. Alcohol, produced by fermentation that depends on microscopic fungi, is such an indelible part of human history and joymaking that in many traditions, it is honored as a gift from the gods. Contrary to its present reputation, it has also been viewed as a giver of wisdom. The Greek historian Herodotus tells of a tribe in the Near East whose council of elders would never sustain a decision they made when sober unless they also confirmed it under the influence of strong wine. Or, if they came up with something while intoxicated, they would also have to agree with themselves after sobering up. None of these substances could affect us unless they worked on natural processes in the human brain and made use of the brain's innate chemical apparatus. Drugs influence and alter how we act and feel because they resemble the brain's own natural chemicals. This likeness allows them to occupy receptor sites on our cells and interact with the brain's intrinsic messenger systems. But why is the human brain so receptive to drugs of abuse. Nature couldn't have taken millions of years to develop the incredibly intricate system of brain circuits, neurotransmitters, and receptors that become involved in addiction just so people could get high to escape their troubles or have a wild time.